You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neugebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Neugebauer, and today we are joined by a very special guest in studio, Greg Ruggeroni. And if you think back to about the beginning of the year in January when there were all sorts of news stories coming out about pink salmon and how pink salmon are thriving and how that fact may have something to do with the decline of our endangered southern resident orcas. So I'll leave you with that teaser and we'll loop around back to our interview in just a moment. But I wanted to let you know about some exciting upcoming events. August 8th, at the Downtown Patagonia store, Whale Scout, Save Our Wild Salmon, and Defenders of Wildlife is hosting a film screening for Damned to Extinction. If you haven't seen it yet, it's a really great film about the Columbia and Snake River and connections with southern resident killer whales. And the event is free, and we'll be there, and you can come meet us. It'll be a lot of fun. August 11th is, of course, our second Sunday sightings day, and we'll be at beaches all throughout Puget Sound from noon to 2, and we'll be out helping you spot whales, look at other wildlife, and learn more about what we're going to be seeing. You can find the exact locations on our Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/whalescout. Also, throughout the summer, we've been working with our partners up in the San Juan Islands to station naturalists at the Westside Preserve and now also at Lime Kiln down by the whale watching wall. And if you go to on Facebook, the San Juan Island Naturalist Program, just about every week on Thursday, there's a post and it tells you where and when naturalists will be out and you can meet up with them, say if you're on vacation or if you want to go up for the day, hang out with someone for a little while and learn more about the ecosystem in the San Juan Islands. It's a great, fun, and free thing to do. Lastly, we're heading towards the end of the summer and, of course, we are excited for fall. Not only is it salmon season in the Puget Sound area, but it's also planting season. So keep an eye out for fall planting events that will be on our website, whalescout.org. We are back here on the Whale Scout Podcast with Greg Ruggeroni, and we are so lucky that you are in studio today. Thank you so much for coming over and for chatting with us. Greg is the president of Natural Resources Consultants. So could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about what you do?
Yeah, I'm a salmon researcher. I've been researching salmon, Pacific salmon, for the past 40 years. I look at population trends across the North Pacific. We'll talk about that a little bit today. Especially looking at pink salmon and their interactions with other species on the high seas, but also ecology management in freshwater, fisheries management, all aspects of salmon.
And so pink salmon have been sort of your focus lately. And what makes pink salmon different than other salmon species?
Well, first off, pink salmon are exceptionally abundant. There's actually more Pacific salmon today, for example, 2005 through 2015, than ever before in recorded history. We published a paper last year, 2018, Marine and Coastal Fisheries, demonstrating salmon abundance trends from 1925 through 2015 in both Asia and North America. And there's quite a bit more salmon today than ever before. The problem is, for most of us, is that nearly 70% of those salmon returning from the ocean are pink salmon. They average about 650 million pink salmon in odd-numbered years, and quite a bit fewer in even-numbered years. And it's because of this high abundance and this biennial alternating year pattern of abundance that we use pink salmon as a tool to study species interactions in the North Pacific Ocean.
And so why are there so many pink salmon, and why is it different now than it has been in the past?
Well, good question. The big increase, rise in pink salmon, occurred at the 1977 ocean regime shift. It was a major reorganization of species in the North Pacific Ocean in the mid-70s. Ocean temperatures became quite a bit warmer, especially in the wintertime period, and pink salmon, which is a species that has a fixed two-year life cycle, that's why they only they show this strong biennial pattern of abundance. They grow incredibly fast, they eat lots of food, and they took advantage of the warmer temperatures in the ocean and produced a lot more fish.
And so now, how have the other salmon species also been impacted by some of the same drivers that have been beneficial for pink salmon?
So both pinks and sockeye salmon have increased. Sockeye have doubled in abundance. But they are largely driven by, for example, Brusta Bay sockeye salmon, which has just had phenomenal abundance in recent years. And that's because they are up in the Bering Sea, where water temperatures, for example, tend to be cooler. But slight warming has been, since the mid-70s and in recent years, has been quite favorable to early marine growth and survival of Brusta Bay sockeye. But sockeye from Brusta Bay still interact with Asian pink salmon. We've have several publications looking at this, demonstrating during their second and third years in the ocean, they compete for food, and sockeye experience reduced growth and reduced survival in relation to those pink salmon.
And so what does that mean for other critters in the food chain with all these pink salmon? Are there winners? Are there losers? Well, what are the implications of, you know, all these pink salmon?
Definitely. There are winners and losers. Brusta Bay sockeye have been doing well, but we do show a negative impact. Another paper we published related closer to here in the Salish Sea, in 2015, we studied 36 sockeye populations from in the Salish Sea, the Fraser River, going all the way up through Southeast Alaska. And all of these had negative patterns of abundance, survival, growth, and age of maturation with pink salmon. In other words, when high abundance of pink salmon, they have low survival of Fraser sockeye salmon. We also have some work looking at pink salmon interactions with Chinook salmon in the high seas. We can see in the high seas, for example, in the central Bering Sea region, diet studies by Nancy Davis, formerly of the University of Washington, has demonstrated a biennial pattern in the diet and food consumption of Chinook salmon, where in odd numbered years when these pinks are exceptionally abundant in that region, key prey of small fishes and squid is greatly reduced. She also demonstrates that pinks are eating these same prey, even though pinks tend to feed on zooplankton. That's what they're known for, is feeding on copepods and smaller euphausids. They also eat fishes and squid, which are important to coho salmon and Chinook in the high seas. We also demonstrated in another paper published last year in Fisheries Oceanography with two oceanographers, one Yvonne Ortiz from the University of Washington and Sonia Batten from British Columbia. We demonstrated a trophic cascade caused by the high abundance of pink salmon in the Bering Sea and North Pacific Ocean. These pink salmon in years of high abundance, in odd years, the zooplankton that they're consuming had very low abundance, whereas in even-numbered years, when there are a few pink salmon, zooplankton abundance increased dramatically. This is a data set collected over a 14-year time period using continuous plankton recorders towed behind commercial ships. It's a data set that Sonia Batten is responsible for. It's a very robust data set, but also in those years when zooplankton abundance is reduced because of pink salmon, phytoplankton abundance bumps up, increases. So you see this jagged biennial pattern in both phytoplankton and zooplankton, but in opposite directions. And it's linked to the high abundance, in this case, of eastern Kamchatka Russian pink salmon that we know from tagging studies inhabit this central Bering Sea North Pacific region. So not only do we see its biennial pattern, but we can also do correlation analyses to show a trend between these species.
So are you saying then that perhaps the pink salmon are eating the same food as the Chinook salmon would be going after, so that possibly Chinook salmon aren't faring as well?
At times, yes. In the central North Pacific, they do share a lot of the same food. In other regions, they don't. Chinook tend to feed at the higher trophic levels, feeding more on small fishes and squid. And pink salmon are not able to eat those types of prey until they get larger, such as in their second growing season at sea. But on the other hand, pink salmon are eating a lot of the zooplankton, species that are important to the prey that those Chinook are feeding on. So there's multiple ways that pink salmon can interact with Chinook salmon. In 2005, a colleague and I, Fred Goetz, published a paper in the Canadian Journal of Fisheries Aquatic Sciences where we analyzed over 50 million tagged Chinook salmon from hatcheries throughout the Salish Sea. And from 1983 through 1997, the last year of our data set, we saw a 60% reduction in the release to adult return survival rate of Chinook salmon, quite dramatic. And that pattern was consistent among all the different released sub-yearling hatchery fish, indicating a negative association with pink salmon that in the Salish Sea region, pink salmon are exceptionally abundant as adults in odd numbered years. And in this case, we could tell from the coated wire tag data that this interaction was occurring during their first year in the Salish Sea. So in other words, there was an interaction, we think, between the juvenile pinks that are exceptionally abundant in even numbered years with those juvenile Chinook that are migrating in those same even years. That pattern, we haven't analyzed the data in recent years. There have been a number of changes in the coated wire tag program, but some colleagues have looked at some of the data, and the pattern is not nearly as strong as what it once was.
So would that work be related to some of the work that, like, Long Live the Kings is doing on marine survival, the early marine survival period?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they've some of the people have spoken to me about some of the interactions between pink salmon and Chinook.
And so now, you know, earlier this year, there was a lot of reports and media that came out about your work in relating pink salmon now to endangered southern resident killer whales. Tell us what that's all about.
So it's really discovery. So my co-authors on this paper that came out earlier this year, Alan Springer, he's emeritus faculty, University of Alaska, Gus Van Vliet, independent scientist in Southeast Alaska, and Leon Shaw, who just retired this month from Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We all use pink salmon to study interactions with other species. Alan and Gus, they're specialty really is looking at pink salmon interaction with seabirds. They've published some fascinating work there. Anyways, we were looking at the southern resident population data that are available online at the Center for Whale Research, and looking at one of their graphs, it took us literally just a minute or two to see this biennial pattern in the mortality of southern residents. It began around 1998 and continued all the way through year 2017. This is up, down, alternating year pattern where mortality was very high in even-numbered years and low in odd-numbered years. So immediately I called a couple of colleagues that I work with in the salmon world, but also fellows that published papers on southern resident population, Mike Ford, and Eric Ward at NOAA Fisheries, asked them, have have you looked at this pattern, notice this pattern? And it caught them off guard. They hadn't noticed it before. So we started looking into it more and more. And the interesting thing here is that the southern resident population does not eat pink salmon. Pink salmon are incredibly abundant in the Salish Sea. On those odd numbered years, there's on average about 18 million pink salmon returning to the Fraser River and Puget Sound, and only less than 500,000 in adjacent even numbered years. The whales are present when lots of pink salmon are swimming through the San Juan Islands where the whales are foraging, but it's clear that these whales don't eat pinks. In a sense, they avoid them. Pink salmon are surface-oriented, so they're swimming right in front of the whales when they're foraging near the surface. And so we looked into the data more and more, looked at the birth rates, successful birth rates of the whales. Data were provided by Ken Balcom. I spoke to him a couple of times by phone and by email, gained access to the tremendous data sets that the Center for Whale Research gathers over the years, incredibly valuable, and wrote this up because it's so important to get this type of observation out to the scientific community so they can start looking for these biennial patterns that we describe.
And so what were some of those results? You found, you were mentioning a high mortality rate in the even years. And what else were you finding?
Well, the high mortality rate is key. So in even numbered years from 1998 through 2017, a 20-year time period, in even numbered years, there's 3.6 times greater likelihood or greater mortality than in the adjacent odd numbered years. In terms of number of whales, that was 65 whales that died in even numbered years and only 17 whales in odd numbered years. A very strong pattern and fairly consistent throughout that 20-year time period. And that time period corresponds nearly exactly with the period of decline. The whales, going back to 1976, when Ken Balcom's data set began, there was, I think, roughly 75 whales. The population grew up to about 95 whales in 1995, partly because restrictions on the harvest for aquaria of those whales. But in 1995 through present day, the whale population has been declining. So throughout this entire period of decline, we see this biennial pattern. In the years prior to 1998, that pattern is not obvious. Now that time period, 1997-98, is a very interesting time period. A lot of things was taking place in the ocean at that time. We have the 1997-1998 ocean regime shift that impacted a lot of species in the marine waters, including salmon. We also have, at that time period, a great reduction in commercial fishing in the Salish Sea, especially that for Chinook salmon, you know, they have become listed, and there were fewer harvests on Chinook salmon beginning in the early 1990s. And because of that, there were fewer harvests on pink salmon. Also, there's concern over sockeye salmon, for example, returning to the Fraser River. So the harvest rates on sockeye that are occurring when these pinks are returning was reduced. And because of that, beginning in 1999 through present days, there was more than a doubling of pink salmon abundance in the Salish Sea. So here's a situation where, quite interesting, we talk about ecosystem management, but there's, you know, conservation concerns for Chinook salmon, of course, and sockeye salmon. We reduce the commercial harvest on those species, but in doing so, we allow another species, pink salmon, to greatly increase in abundance.
And so what exactly is the connection? Why is an abundance of pink salmon threatening the killer whales?
Well, good question. we have the same question, and so the pink salmon idea is it's really a hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my colleagues and I, we study pink salmon in the North Pacific, and we look for other species that might show biennial patterns of abundance like pink salmon. And within the range of the southern resident population, we know of no other species that has this biennial pattern that might explain this pattern we see in killer whale births and mortality. It's obvious the biennial pattern that we see in these long-lived orca cannot be explained by environmental conditions, such as, you know, climate factors, physical oceanographic features, other factors of decline of the whales that people have identified, such as, you know, toxic contaminants, or boat noise. There has to be some sort of interaction with some species out there in the North Pacific within the range of the orca that shows a strong biennial pattern. And the one species that stands out in like this is the pink salmon, which in the Salish Sea, as I mentioned, on average 18 million pinks in odd years and only 500,000 or less in even-numbered years.
How many Chinook salmon would you predict would be in the Salish Sea during that same time period to give a comparison?
Well, in the paper, we do look at that. I forget the numbers right off the top of my head. But roughly, the pink salmon are returning from roughly mid-July through early September, a key time period when summer Chinook and early run fall Chinook are returning to the Salish Sea. And that's a prime feeding area within the Salish Sea for the orca. And roughly speaking, we're looking at roughly 50 times more pink salmon than Chinook salmon. Our working hypothesis, we think the interaction occurs through interference. The whales can, we know from other studies, can easily identify a large Chinook compared to a pink salmon or sockeye salmon. But we think that, you know, these pink salmon are coming in high densities. They're following the same pathway as Chinook salmon through the Salish Sea. The whales, killer whales, are foraging along the west coast of San Juan Island and through Boundary Pass, the same area where, of course, the Chinook are migrating, but also the pink salmon. Pink salmon are more surface-oriented. Chinook are down deeper. The whales are using echolocation, trying to search out, find the Chinook to attack. We suspect that maybe somehow the large number of pink salmon interferes with their ability to detect and catch Chinook salmon.
It's a really interesting hypothesis, and it almost is so difficult for us whale people to like wrap our minds around there being so many other fish out there that it makes it difficult for the whales to find the prey that they're looking for. It almost seems like, you know, when we think about the orca situation, that there are just so few salmon out there, it's almost like they're in an empty ocean. So idea of there being so many, but of the wrong kind of salmon, right, it's very unique and I think a really interesting idea. And the data is very, very compelling to look at these trends and understand that there's something going on here.
Yeah, and that's the key thing. Something's going on. We need to figure out what it is, work on that mechanism. If it is pink salmon, there are actions we can take to try to help fix the problem. But beyond what people are already trying to do, which is trying to increase Chinook salmon abundance through habitat restoration and perhaps the hatchery situation. But one thing I should mention is that a question that I often get from people, such as yourself, is why don't the whales eat pink salmon? Or why don't they eat sockeye? And so, you know, Mike Ford has looked at the diet of the orca, as well as John Ford up in British Columbia and others, Brad Hansen, and you know, they clearly prefer Chinook, large, big, old Chinook, over sockeye or pinks that are co-migrating with them. And it's probably, I suspect, you know, it's a behavioral thing. You know, these killer whales, the orca, are learning from the matriarch, and it's a social thing. They're learning what to eat, and so far they haven't taken made a choice to eat a few pink salmon. Maybe they, you know, they're, the pinks are probably the least favorite of humans as well, and so yeah,
something to that. What have you looked at other killer whale populations that also eat salmon? Like, what about the northern residents or Alaskan residents? Do they exhibit any of these same patterns?
Yeah, good question. I looked at some of the data. I didn't have a complete data set for the northern resident population. Eric Ward presented some of those data to me. But, you know, that's a different population. They are mostly, you know, halfway up Vancouver Island and north into southeast Alaska. The data that I did have shows that their population is growing, and there's no obvious biennial pattern in their abundance. One other thing I should clarify to the listeners is they probably picked up that I mentioned that the mortality is high in even years, but yet adult pink salmon are abundant in odd years, which is interesting because what we think is happening there is that this interference is occurring in the odd years, but these are large, robust animals, the orca are, and it takes them roughly on average a year before that negative impact of interaction, we think, with pink salmon occurs. And that's supported by some research that John Ford did back in 2010, linking orca feeding on Chinook salmon to their mortality. His data indicated about a one-year lag time between the abundance of Chinook and mortality.
Right. So this is 2019. This is an odd year. So this is an abundant pink year, right? So,
well, it is. So things, pink salmon are also a boom-bust species because they have this fixed two-year life cycle. And so they've been booming in recent years, but in 2017, the run of pink salmon was not in the Salish Sea, not nearly as large as what it had been in 2015 and earlier. And so in 2019, the forecast for this region is quite a bit lower. So things are changing, so we'll see. And looking at these biennial patterns, it's something you can't just look at one or two years. You need a time series.
Okay.
But still, I think people are out there looking, I hope, for some of these biennial patterns, and we'll see what happens with the pink salmon run that comes back this year.
So what do you predict for the future, and what sort of management implications, you know, should more of your data set kind of come together? I mean, should we be harvesting these pink salmon like crazy? I mean, what could be done?
Yeah, well, first off, you know, if we find that the pink salmon have an adverse impact on orcas feeding on Chinook, one management option would be to selectively harvest pink salmon before they get into the feeding area of the orca. Now, there's a lot of selective fishing going on. It's somewhat controversial depending on the type of gear. And there's catch and release mortality. That's a big concern because there are other species such as Chinook and sockeye that co-migrate with sockeye. So you'd have to be careful. You'd have to use selective gear such as a purse seine. You wouldn't necessarily want to just open this up to an active, aggressive commercial fishery. You might want to do it on a selective basis where you have people out there being very vigilant and caring for the fish that are caught, having smaller sets so that they can preserve the bycatch, the Chinook and sockeye that might be caught. You can also modify the purse seine, for example, to target the surface-oriented pink salmon. In the commercial fisheries that fished on a regular basis for a period of time along the west coast of San Juan Island, they're using deep nets because they wanted to catch deep Chinook along with the surface-oriented pink salmon. So there are things that could be discussed to try to alleviate this the issue.
So as a salmon researcher, I'd like to pick your brain a little bit about some other aspects of southern resident killer whale recovery and strategies. As you know, in the last year or so, we've had this killer whale task force that the governor has put together, and there have been a few different proposals to try to alleviate and accelerate southern resident recovery and reverse the trends. One of them has been to increase hatchery production of Chinook salmon. What is your opinion on this, and do you think that it's something that is going to do the trick and help dig us out of this hole?
Well, I'll let you know more about that in about a year or so. One, I don't know all the details on the hatchery proposal. I was just appointed to the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, and I know that group, including myself, will be looking at this issue in terms of looking at how the increased hatchery production impacts the genetics, ecological interactions, and harvests of wild natural origin Chinook salmon in relation to the orcas. Just off the top of my head, looking at the hatchery, the proposal, there are certain questions that I just don't know the answer to, and that is hatchery Chinook salmon tend to be smaller and younger and smaller. They mature at a younger age than natural origin Chinook salmon. The whales are foraging on big, old Chinook. That's what they really prefer and what they need. And so I don't know to what extent the hatchery proposals are looking at the age and size of the adults coming back. I review hatcheries in the Columbia River Basin, and there are studies looking at how they can try to manipulate the age at return of Chinook salmon. So this is something that hopefully the people that are proposing hatchery fish are looking at this issue. Another important issue that people have raised is, well, if you increase hatchery production and you get more adults coming back, as Chinook salmon are coming back, what does that do to fishery harvest rates? These Chinook are being harvested from Southeast Alaska through British Columbia and throughout Puget Sound and the West Coast, Washington and Oregon. Will those harvest rates be controlled beyond what they are now in order to preserve some of those extra fish for the orca? So there's questions such as that I still have.
And so are you implying that perhaps that there are harvest interactions? I know NOAA has sort of reinitiated an ESA review of fisheries that are going on in the Columbia and in California. Do you have any opinions on that?
Well, I haven't studied this particular issue in detail in recent years, but I will say, it's obvious that, as I just mentioned, there's a large number of Chinook salmon harvested that are south migrating fish heading towards this general region, the Salish Sea, the range of the southern resident orca, that are harvested in commercial and sport fisheries.
Any other thoughts? If you were in charge of orca recovery and you could wave a magic wand, what you would do to help southern resident killer whales or Chinook salmon recover?
Well, I would pay a little bit more attention to this biennial pattern. There's something going on, and we need to figure out what that is, because that knowledge may help us figure out better solutions.
And for our listeners who live around the world and in Puget Sound and beyond, could you offer them any way that they could get involved with salmon recovery, orca recovery, and some of the work that you're doing and supporting it?
Well, they can contact or read your webpage. You're trying to actively recover the whales through habitat restoration. Get out, speak up, volunteer, support. Number one, support protection of the natural environment. I review a lot of the habitat restoration work. I've done some research on habitat restoration. It's just not easy. It takes a long time to recover the species. And the biggest thing is we need to do a better job protecting the habitat that we have now. And that's a major issue in Alaska, for example, where a lot of my research takes place. But throughout the Northwest, even, we need to do a better job protecting salmon habitat so that our future generations can enjoy salmon.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in studio. If you have any last parting thoughts, otherwise, I want to thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us today about salmon.
Well, thank you very much for being interested in our research, and I look forward. I hope the whales make a comeback. That's an incredible species.
Yeah, well, thank you for your work, and we'll be sure to follow along and learn more when you have more data and more information about these pink salmon and what sort of things might be going on out there in the ocean. So thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. I got a follow-up email from Greg Ruggeroni after our in-studio interview, and he wanted to add another point to his conclusion here. So I'll just go ahead and read you a direct quote from his email. Another point I would like to add to inform your listeners in regard to the biennial pattern of births and deaths of southern resident orcas. During the past 20 years, if births and mortality in even years had been equal to that in odd years, or even close to that in odd years, then the orca population would have increased substantially rather than declined. This simple fact highlights the need to further evaluate the biennial pattern that we discovered. So it's very intriguing stuff here. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you have other suggestions for guests or topics that you would like to hear about, please email podcast@whalescout.org. You can also check out our newly launched website up there, all the past podcast episodes. And if you like to listen on the road, please be sure to hit subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and they'll be sent directly to your phone. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.